everyone, and welcome. This is episode 314 of Milwaukee's Tailgate Brewers Podcast, part of the MKE Tailgate Network. I am James, joined once again after our holiday break by Ryan and Paul. Good to see you guys after a couple of weeks off. Paul, how was Christmas
break
for the kids?
It was, so Christmas for the kids, I think, was pretty good. They got good hauls. We had to go to Minnesota, and it's usually not that, it's fine. It's seeing family. It's not fun because we don't have a house there, so we guys have to stay in hotels. And hotels over Christmas aren't fun. We stayed at the Minneapolis Great Wolf Lodge this time. Don't do that on Christmas.
Christmas specifically or just like in general?
So I'm not going to judge it in totality. I bet when it's a little less full, it's probably much more fun. But it was packed to the gills. And I will say that the one bad thing about that water park in particular is you do not have a good line of sight across the whole thing. And you cannot circumnavigate it in completely. So if you can, you can be like halfway around and only be able to go one way to get back. So if your kids get separated from you, it's hard to see them. I'm actually surprised that they don't have better parent vantage points. And my kids are good swimmers, but they're still fairly small. And they were definitely, they have lifeguards, but like there was a zillion people there. Anyway, it seemed fine. But it is also the giantest money suck of all time, too. So need a plan on that place. But not doing that again. Don't do it over holiday. It is not as fun if it's packed.
Oof. Yeah. I know of the Great Wolf Lodge in the Dells, but I can't imagine the Twin Cities version. And having to keep small children in your line of sight at all times seems stressful.
I think, subjectively, I think it's quite a bit smaller than the Dells one is. I'm not sure. I haven't been in that one. But it seemed smaller than when I drive past the Great Wolf Lodge and see the outside of it. So that too.
Yeah. Yeah. Ryan, how was your week off?
Good. We just recorded a minor league extra. James and I got one out there. So that was good. And we took a look around the NL Central, and James reassured me that the Cubs system isn't the crap that I want it to be. So there was that. But we looked around. It is, he really does think the Cardinals are pretty bad. So that's wonderful. That's really quite helpful. So yeah, we took a look at all those things and then just kind of looked at some big picture questions about the farm system, like where it's at. So I think people find that interesting.
Yeah, definitely. And that's a good segue reminder that you can get that on Patreon. The $5 level, go to patreon.com/MKETailgate. $2 a month gets you question priority both on this podcast and on reporting as eligible. Yeah. Which
big the day Lions, for reporting as eligible.
I was gonna say the Lions either did or didn't, depending on if you're asking the refs or anybody with eyes. So I imagine that'll be a fun topic of conversation there.
We'll definitely talk about that at least a little bit on this week's show. Yes.
That'll Oof, man, that was a really interesting final 2 minutes. I'll just say that
people are still arguing about it on Twitter, and you can't even know, like, there's always going to be some ambiguity. So don't call super complex plays in high leverage situations is probably a good rule of thumb. You're dealing with stupid officials, and this official in particular, who botched this call, probably botched the call, is the same official who officiated the Packers Chiefs game that ended with that bad call on Patrick Mahomes roughing going out of bounds and the Marquez Valdes-Scantling non-call on pass interference. And so he's had a rough season, especially on national TV.
Oof. Yeah. Can't wait for him to call the Super Bowl, I bet.
Yep.
All right. so that's the $2 level. $5 gets you that question priority plus the additional exclusive content. Ryan's minor league extra, as he just mentioned, new episode just dropped in the past week. Always a good chance to sign up for that $5 level there. And then you also get Paul's Packers mini pods, which have been really spot on as the Packers lose to teams they shouldn't and somehow beat the teams they shouldn't beat. So we're doing this on Sunday morning before the Packers play prime time on Sunday night. Probably get embarrassed by a 28-year-old rookie from BYU.
Probably. The Vikings are smart and we have at least one guy who's dumb, so that doesn't always work in our favor.
And the guy who's dumb is calling the defense
against one of the smartest play callers in the league. No quarterback, but good plays.
All right. Yeah, I am nervous, but I'll await your guys' breakdown of that. In the meantime, Paul's mini pods always end up basically predicting the future. He's practically Nostradamus. So, yeah. All right. Another reminder, too, as always, you can support us another way. Go to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever else you listen to us. Give us a 5-star review there. Tell your friends about us and hit that subscribe or follow button to make sure you never miss an episode. So, you know, we took the week off for Christmas, just kind of figuring that, you know, not a lot would happen. And lo and behold, the Brewers made a trade, because that's what happens every single time we decide we're going to skip a week. So just the week before Christmas, actually, Matt Arnold actually made his first trade with his old boss, David Stearns. The Brewers, of course, if you don't remember, because I frankly kind of just forgot it happened too in the course of the last couple of weeks. But they traded Tyrone Taylor and Adrian Hauser to the Mets for an injured pitcher named Coleman Crowe. So I guess, first of all, my impression was like this felt like a crazy salary dump. Just get a couple of ARB guys off the team for, you know, maybe a pitcher who could be something next year, but probably not this year. I know Ryan's looked at some stuff that makes him more optimistic that Coleman Crowe could be something. But we do have a couple of Patreon questions about that. So let's just jump right in. Jay Google asking our first question this week, asking, so is Crowe a solid enough return for Hauser and Taylor? And does it make sense to make this move? So, Paul, let's start with you. I know I felt like it was a salary dump. How about you?
It does seem kind of salary dumpish, just because the person that you're getting back is so speculative. And he might turn out to be something very worthwhile. He certainly has more control than what you sent away. But Hauser and Taylor are, if not great players, at least valuable players. Hauser's a valuable innings eater. Taylor is a valuable bench bat who can step in and start for a little bit. You know, they're not super duper great, but I do think it's weird to trade away some fairly certain war, like not a ton, but like what, like a win and a half to 2 wins between the two of them, for a guy who's definitely not going to help you this season and might turn into something, but there's no chance he'll ever help you. Like guys who can't throw the ball currently won't necessarily come back. So it seemed very financially motivated to me. It seems like a throw some guys who aren't going to be around long term for spaghetti, which fine, we're the Brewers, but it does seem mostly financially motivated to me. If you were going to get the typical Brewer trade, would have a guy that could maybe help you this year and was a little bit more of a not sure thing, but a potential contributor.
Yeah. So first off, let's like define our terms here. So MLB Trade Rumors had Adrian Hauser projected for $5.6 million in his final year of arbitration. And Tyrone Taylor is going into his first year of arbitration, so he's projected for 1.7. So total, you're looking at a little bit over 7 there, depending on what they end up settling for. So they definitely did clear payroll here, like that, for sure.
Absolutely, they did. Yes.
Yeah, like there's
that is
no
the thing
doubting
that happened.
Yeah, they definitely cleared payroll and have a lower payroll now as a result of this. I guess then it comes down to a question of like what you think of Adrian Hauser and what you think of Tyrone Taylor, and what they're likely to give you. I think it's two pretty different situations, because Taylor, they did have 3 years of control left, but he
space
was...
Space is the problem there, yeah.
Right, space is the problem there, and playing time is the problem there. They have so many outfielders, and they just, you know, like they needed to move somebody. And we all sort of expected there was a good chance they were going to move Tyrone Taylor this winter, right? Like that seemed to make sense. Like
yes.
So that part of it is a little bit weird, in that he has 3 years of control and he's not that expensive this year. You would think maybe you could get more just for him than Coleman Crowe, which makes me wonder if Adrian Hauser is almost like a non-entity in this trade. Like they're basically, I wonder if the Mets are treating him almost as like, yeah, we will take him because we could use the back end innings, but they're not, you know, giving him credit for any surplus value on top of this. So I think there's a good chance that that's kind of the way this is working, that they basically viewed Adrian Hauser as almost like a guy who sort of almost doesn't even matter in the trade, that he was like a throw-in in it.
Yeah.
Because he's not, I don't think they're getting additional value here from Adrian Hauser. And that comes down to like, well, okay, what do you think of Adrian Hauser? And if you look over the past 4 years, he's had two pretty decent seasons, including 2023, but he's also in 2020 and 2022 been below replacement level. So I think the mileage varies on what Adrian Hauser is actually worth in this whole thing. And that's, I think that's kind of the crux of it. There's also the other thing here is both of them are roster locked. So we know the Brewers like guys who have options, and both Taylor and Hauser are out of options. So the only way to get them off of the active roster would be a trip to the IL. Like, that's their only option to move them off of the active roster. And sort of given the depth that the Brewers have at both positions between, you know, they brought in Miley, they brought back Ray, they brought in Joe Ross. Between those moves and just obviously we've already talked about the glut of outfield, which has now been increased by the fact that I think we all think that Jackson Chourios probably making the opening day roster now.
Right. Yep. Absolutely.
All of that. It's like, well, it's not that there's not room for them on the roster. It's just that, like, it's a little bit tricky. And so I think the Mets had, weirdly, because, you know, they've gotten rid of so many players, they actually have more roster room than the Brewers do for that stuff. And so I think from that perspective, it's a little bit easier just for them to be able to take on those guys.
But I think that description does fairly characterize this as a salary dump, because what you just laid out is that we maybe should have gotten more back for Taylor, but got less back for Taylor because we got rid of Adrian Hauser's salary plus a not that great pitcher.
Yeah, right. But that would then be a miscalculation on Arnold's part if they, because they didn't have to tender Hauser. They could have non-tendered Hauser. So it's right. Not like they were obligated to bring back, and actually they still could have released. There's you are not obligated if you, like, in arbitration, if you decide not to carry a guy into the season, there's the potential to not have to pay that salary. So there's like a backdoor way out of that if you don't like the result and all of that. So I don't know that's all that, like, big a deal either. I'm still not quite sure what to think of this. I do think we got to talk about Coleman Crowe. The big write-up, and James and I discussed this on the Minor League Extra, was Baseball America wrote up that they're really sort of intrigued by him, and they literally called him a fascinating target. So first off, he's still very young. He had to go on the 40 man this year, but is only 22 years old, and he never actually pitched for the Mets. He was traded over from the Angels, and I kind of love the idea of getting guys from the Angels because the Angels don't know what the hell they're doing. So I sort of feel like there's a good chance that there's still untapped potential here. And if you look at what he was doing before he got hurt this year, he had actually made quite a leap forward last year. In 2021 at the A-ball level, he was walking over four batters per nine. And in 2022, he already dropped that down to 2.46 and further improved it this year down to 2.25. And his strikeout numbers have been increasing. They went up to 9 in 2022 and then jumped to 11.63 per nine this year. And he was looking very, very good before he wound up getting hurt, having Tommy John surgery. He gets traded to the Mets sort of in this time period over the summer, and then the Mets turn around and flip him to us. And I think what a lot of people saw here instantly was this guy is ranked number 29 by MLB Pipeline in the Mets system. And people said, whoa, so he's just worthless. MLB Pipeline, like any other organization, is going to move a guy down when they have surgery like this, and they're going to downgrade the prospect status of that guy. He obviously wouldn't be that in the normal situation. One thing that James mentioned on the Minor League Extra was when there's a trust and a relationship between front offices, it's easier to deal injured, particularly pitchers, because the Brewers can talk to the Mets and sort of get a more honest assessment or feel more confident in that they're not being sold a bill of goods when they get somebody like Coleman Crowe. So I think from that perspective, he is an interesting guy. There's the potential here for him to be a, you know, potentially a very good reliever, or even, you know, like a mid to back end sort of starter. And if you do get that out of him, obviously you're getting that for 6+ years of control. And, you know, when you're comparing that to what you had left of Hauser, obviously that's a big upgrade. The Taylor thing is a little bit weird just because he had some control, but he's also been, you know, he's coming off of a year where he was very, very bad. Well, first he was hurt, then he was very bad, then he was very good. So how much value Tyrone Taylor has is also sort of an open question in all of it. But I do think there's something here with Coleman Crowe, but we are going to have to wait. I mean, he had Tommy John surgery relatively late in the year. I wouldn't expect to see him really throwing in games at all this year in his age 23 season coming up. By the way, he did just turn 23 yesterday. So that was funny.
Oh, happy birthday, Coleman.
When I was looking at his date, his birthday, I was like, oh, it's 12:30. Look at that. Okay. So I wouldn't expect to see that. But him coming back and pitching, you know, in his age 24 season in 2025, that's not particularly old for making a comeback from Tommy John surgery. So.
Sure. Yeah. In something that I had totally forgotten about, but a lot of these guys in this age range too, he was drafted in 2019, which means he basically lost his entire first year of pro ball in 2020 as well. So he's one of those guys where maybe the age is a little bit misleading in terms of A, mileage on the arm, and B, development still. So kind of interesting. Sounds like he's got an awesome breaking ball, unique fastball, I think is what Baseball America said. So it sounds like a Brewers-y pitch characteristics kind of guy. So
yeah, especially that fastball thing where it's like it seems to play up and guys don't hit it as well as you would think. That sounds like so many Brewers over the years that
Peralta, you know, exactly.
Yeah. Though you have to wonder a little bit. I mean, David Stearns, the fact that David Stearns let him go and was willing to do this, but I mean, there's also the matter of you have to give something to get something. So, you know, he was not a guy who was going to impact their roster this year. And I think they obviously were looking to add some pieces that could just maybe edge them towards respectability this year.
Sure. We do have one more question about this trade, and it kind of touches on something that I guess this is what took me by surprise when it comes to the trade, in that, you know, we figured Adrian Hauser would at least be, you know, a valuable back end rotation guy, especially after Brandon Woodruff's injury, right? Like he figured to slot into a rotation spot and just be kind of like a dependable starter. Obviously, Brewers decided to move on. So Lucroy Suitcase asking, does the Mets trade mean one of the pitching prospects has a chance to make the opening day roster now? Ryan, let's start with you on that one.
Yeah, I mean, it obviously increases the chances for somebody like Gosser because, like I said, Adrian Hauser was roster locked. He was going to have to be on that opening day roster. Now he's not there. They still have, obviously, they have five guys ahead of Robert Gosser.
Right.
That's, you know, but that could also change in both directions. It could be that they add guys who are sort of ahead of Gosser, or they subtract somebody like Burns, who we've got a bunch of questions about, so we'll wait on that. But like this could sort of go in different directions from that perspective. But I think, this obviously increases the chances for Robert Gosser to make the opening day roster. I don't know that I would necessarily bet on it, but I think he is the number six today as things stand in terms of, well, that's not even necessarily true because what the hell to do with Aaron Ashby? But we have Aaron Ashby questions coming up too, so we'll talk about that later.
Yep. There's a lot of, I mean, there's Ashby. There's other people on the 40-man still that could be ahead of him too, just because they want to keep to that as well. So, like, you might randomly throw Junk or Small out there for a couple of spot starts too, at least in the early season, if things go south.
Yeah, I don't think Small at this point, he's pretty much just a reliever. I don't think he started any games or went really longer than maybe like an inning plus, you know, a little bit. I think he's pretty much a reliever at this point. I think
he's pretty much toast, but yeah.
Yeah, that is probably the more accurate way to say that, yes. But yeah, Junk, Kurt just wrote a whole thing about Junk, and he thinks he could maybe benefit from moving to the bullpen because he thinks his stuff will play up potentially out of the bullpen, but I think there's also still a chance somebody like him. You're right. Yep. Yeah, I think, and the 40 man thing is a very good point. Like, you, especially early on like that, they don't necessarily want to juggle those things. And Gosser isn't on the 40.
I feel like every year we actually have some conversation similar to this, and then it happens, and then some garbage guy who is on the 40 man gets a start. I feel like it's an annual tradition. It's usually only one or two, but it does seem to happen.
Yeah, especially early season when you're just kind of filling gaps as guys get up to speed. So, all right. The other big thing that happened the week before Christmas, surprise, Merry Christmas. Pecota projections are out. Thank you, Jonathan, for that little gift. So obviously a lot to go over when it comes to the projections. I know Ryan's got some things that popped out to him, but I don't really have an agenda for this. I just basically say, hey, we all have the spreadsheet. Paul, what pops out to you?
Oh, the first thing that pops out to me is Joey Weimer better be careful. You know why?
Why?
Because his top comp is Brian Anderson.
Uh-oh.
Well, he's not on Craig's
no, the doghouse is gone. Yes,
yeah, the doghouse is gone.
No, I think the place to start is just the continued love affair that Pecota has with Christian Yelich.
Yes.
And the continued non-love affair that Baseball Prospectus's WAR actually has with Christian Yelich, because those two seem a little bit out of whack. Yelich is the leader for the projected WAR at 5.1, which seems really, really high. As Ryan was pointing out before the podcast, a lot of that is tied up in defensive value in left field. And he hasn't hit that WAR since 2019. So it's been a while since he was in the ballpark of being a 5 WAR player. He was a 2.7 WAR player last year. He was 2.4 the year before. So I'm not sure what to make of that. I'm going to ask Jonathan about it, because there seems to be a big discrepancy here between what they think Yelich can still do and what he actually has been doing for a really long time now.
Yeah, and what's weird too about that is that, like, Yelich was an over 4-win player according to Fangraphs by their calculation of how things go.
Yes, he was.
So he was a much better player according to Fangraphs last year, but I'm going to go out on a limb and guess that Szymborski doesn't have a 5.1 on him when the full Zips player projections come out for next year. I'll actually look and see what the initial projections are here. But yeah, it's almost like there's a disconnect here between what Pecota thinks and what...
Yeah, and we know some of it. We know Yelich is good at controlling the zone. He is good at taking walks. And Pecota usually sees that as an indication that pitchers are afraid of you, that the bat might come around. But like, you got to like take the 3-year weighted average of that in consideration too, right? Like, the bat's not coming around, guys. It's not going to happen.
Yeah, I mean, he was better last year than he had been at any point since 2019, but he still was a lot closer to, I guess, what he hadn't gotten anywhere near that 2019 number. He was closer to where he was at the bottom than where he is at the top.
Yeah.
So it's, Fangraphs has him at 4.1. So, yeah, and their projections, they don't have the Zips projections on here yet. The Fangraphs depth charts and Steamer projections both have him in the mid twos. So, yeah, it's half of what Pecota is projecting for him. So Pecota seems to be a bit out on the limb here. And I should note, what we're looking at are numbers that I pulled down from Pecota the day they came out. So that was on the 18th. Of December. So we're almost 2 weeks behind here for what, so they may have already made some adjustments to this stuff. So if you're sitting here going, I can't find these numbers, there's your explanation.
But I mean, you guys kind of mentioned this is a long time thing with Pecota and I guess Yelich in specific, or maybe more players, but it just pops out to us because every year, every December, every January, we do this and we like, can you believe what Pecota projected for Christian Yelich? Because I pulled up our spreadsheet from last year and the projections in last year's Prospectus Annual had him at 4.4 warp and 116 DRC plus. So again, as you mentioned, he ended up at 2.7 warp and 107 DRC plus. Yeah. So they've been high on him for a while. And it does seem like those 2018, 2019 numbers should be sort of phased out of the projections at some point. I don't know.
Yeah. So speaking of the top end of the hitter thing, before we move on to other stuff, I noted that there's a big gap between you have Yelich at 5.1, you have Adames at 3.3, which seems perfectly plausible to me.
That seems fine. A lot of defensive value there.
And, yeah, a lot of defensive value and probably bounce back coming offensively compared to where he was last year. If you wanted to bet for it to bounce back the other direction, I think that's a pretty safe place to be. And then William Contreras, maybe a little bit lower than what we thought, certainly less than what his numbers were on Fangraphs, but 2.6. Then there's this big gap with three guys who are no longer on the roster.
That's right.
Jesse Winker at his 1.4 projection. They're expecting him to be a 12% better than league average hitter.
By the way, Jesse Winker's comps are insane.
I was waiting to talk about this because I know you love the comps.
I do. And but those are... What?
Carl Yastrzemski, Rafael Palmeiro, and Elvin Davis.
Even Elvin Davis is, I think, too good, let alone the other two.
They're still heavily weighting what he was when he was a very good hitter coming into the 2022 season. You know, it was very good before that point, and now it's been two seasons since he was anything like that.
Yeah.
And they haven't adjusted down on that, so that's a little, I don't know, you wondered, like, did Yastrzemski have, like, a weird thing where, like, in the late 60s, he had a little bit of a career slump before he, you know, took off again in the 70s? I don't know. But, yeah, Winker, Tyrone Taylor at 1.3, and then Carlos Santana at 1.2, and I think I'm still, you know, I would be perfectly happy having Carlos Santana come back for one more year at first base. And I think that's quite possible that's going to happen. And it has been reported around that they've asked.
Then Yastrzemski, 66 was not a great year. It was sandwiched between awesome years, but it was a down year for him. So there you go.
Interesting. Yeah. So maybe it's like a circumstantial situation too. Who knows? Yeah. But then you finally get to the next guy, and that's Sal Frelick. And he's projected for just one win. So the Brewers have kind of a top-heavy offense, which
with guys who aren't great at offense, I might add.
Yeah, and it's kind of built around a lot of guys. Like, so Tyler Black is projected for 0.8 wins, while Weimer and Mitchell, and I think part of this is playing time, honestly. Like, they're not projecting Weimer and Mitchell to get, you know, a ton of plate appearances, 163 for Weimer and 345 for Mitchell.
True.
But those guys are projected for, you know, 0.4 WAR. Whereas, you know, like Tyler Black is projected for 370. So they're not projecting him for like overly a lot either. You could say Pecota really likes Tyler Black's upside. And I think, oh boy, the defensive runs per, they have him at zero. I don't think he's going to be an even player at third base, which I think is where he's going to have to play. So that's a little bit curious in that. But yeah, they're not putting big projections on a lot of these prospects guys.
Yeah, that's not years. That's a percentage that they're like, because Abraham Toro didn't play in 1966. So never mind. Charlie Yastrzemski was randomly bad in 1966. Just a coincidence, not what they're saying.
Oh, okay. And then the other thing here that I think is worth noting, they have a very conservative projection, like embarrassingly conservative projection on Jackson Chourio. They are going to need to bump up the playing time estimates here because they have him only getting 64 plate appearances, which is kind of reasonable for a guy who literally is still 19, hasn't even turned 20 yet, and has like no action at AAA almost. Like, he's, you know, barely gotten his feet wet at AAA. I think that would be a reasonable projection in terms of playing time, but obviously that's not the case anymore because of the commitment that they made to him. Like, that, I think that's a clear signal they're going to do more of that. And I think, you know, the 240, 285, 385 projection for him is low as well. And Judge did talk about this. I saw him talking a little bit on the Bird app about it, saying basically that, no projection system is going to be very good when it comes to players like Chourio because they're just not built to sort of account for him.
You have a huge sample size of 19-year-olds who are not Jackson Chourio, and that's part of this, the projection for Jackson Chourio. So that's part of the problem.
Right.
Yeah. I will say his comps, though, Ronald Acuna Jr., Mike Trout, and Jason Hayward, I would take that. That's
you know what I thought was funny about this? There's two guys comped to Mike Trout on the spreadsheet.
Oh, who's the other?
You got to scroll down really far because it's somebody I've never heard of. Luis Lara.
Ah. Oh, yeah. Okay.
One of the big bonus babies. Yeah.
Yeah. So Luis Lara, no. Just no.
I mean, he's got Julio Rodriguez as another one. So you're telling me, Ryan, that Luis Lara is not turning into Julio Rodriguez or Mike Trout?
I mean, Luis. Yeah. We need to talk a little bit about Luis Lara. So he is the thing, the way this works. And why they are really high on him is the Brewers promoted him all the way up to A-ball as a 19-year-old. He basically made it up to high A as a 19-year-old. He's almost on the path that Chourio was in terms of how quickly they're promoting him. They skipped him completely over the domestic complex league. And so he basically went straight from the DSL as a 17-year-old to as an 18-year-old last year. He's now since turned 19, but he was an 18-year-old last year playing in A-ball and high A. So they love that. And they see that he held his own as an 18-year-old in A-ball and A-plus ball. He hit 116 WRC plus at A ball and a 107 WRC plus at high A. And he was a high bonus baby, so there's like pedigree there. But let's take a step back and appreciate he's 5'7" and 155 pounds.
Oh no.
And awesome. And you're talking about a guy who hit in almost 400 plate appearances. He was just a couple plate appearances short. He had two home runs. So not at all the kind of profile that like Jackson Chourio is. He's an exciting prospect and a legit people are excited about Luis Lara. They legitimately are. We've talked about him on the podcast. James had him in his top 10. People are excited about Luis Lara, but the upside here just is not what you have with Jackson Chourio because he just doesn't have the power upside. He does not project it for that kind of power.
All right, let's talk pitching now, because obviously Brewers have been a very pitching-dependent team. They've lost a big piece in Brandon Woodruff with that injury, and kind of as we talked about, kind of need to piece together a rotation after that. So not surprisingly, Corbin Burnes leading the way with the warp projections. Kurt Schilling comparable there for Corbin Burnes. But after that, it's Freddie Peralta.
The Schilling comp probably more applicable than we all would like, right?
Well, I mean, yeah, depends on what sense you mean. But I mean,
in every possible sense, it seems very, very, very close.
Yeah, I mean, Schilling did have a great second act in his career. He kind of, there was a time period there where, kind of at around the age where Burnes was, people were sort of wondering if he was going to extend his career out and be good because he was a really good young pitcher with the Phillies. And then he sort of embarked on that second act with the Diamondbacks and then the Red Sox, where he was a really, really, really good pitcher again, and that's what put him into Hall of Fame contention. So
right. I did also mean that Burnes might bankrupt a publicly funded video game company at some point.
Yeah, no, I figured that's where you were going with it, yes.
And that's not libel or whatever the speech one is, because it happened. Oh, it's a projection we're talking about.
It's not libel on Schilling at all. Yeah, that actually happened.
That actually happened. For sure. Anyway, Corbin Burnes, number one, but a close number two, Freddie Peralta. So, Ryan, I know you wanted to talk about that because it basically just the difference is really kind of come down to how many innings Pecota thinks they'll pitch, right?
Yeah, they think that basically Peralta is every bit the pitcher that Burnes is on an inning per inning basis, even a little bit better in some ways. They project him to have a an ERA, couple point. Yeah, 2.73 versus 2.75. So very close. But FIPs that are almost identical, CFIPs that are identical, DRAs that are within, you know, just like 0.04 of a point from each other.
Peralta's is better. So
yeah, Peralta's just a little bit better. But the big difference here is Burns at 177 innings and Peralta at 160 innings. And that all seems really plausible to me. Like, that feels like a really good projection. And is a good reminder that Freddie Peralta is still a pretty damn good pitcher, even though he's played, you know, third fiddle behind Burns and Woodruff for quite a while here. And there are durability questions with him that we don't have with, well, Burns especially. They definitely cropped up with Woodruff. But yeah, there's durability concerns there. But, you know, on an inning per inning basis, Freddie Peralta is a pretty damn good pitcher.
Yeah, the Woodruff comps just make you sad. That Strasburg one is just like leaping out at you.
Yeah, it's Adam Wainwright who is like the picture of durability, and then Steven Strasburg, which opposite. Anything else jump out about the pitching to you, Paul?
Not as much on the hitting side. Colin Reyes, I think, is pretty good. I was a little surprised. Like, it's not fantastic by any stretch, but I feel like Colin Ray is, in my brain, still in the just the guy camp. And they project him to basically be league average, which is great. Yeah. If you get league average production out of Colin Ray, you got something working there. And then, of course, Pecota loves strikeout guys and hates pitch to contact guys, which there aren't very many of, especially good ones. But I always like the guys like Wade Miley, who are projected to not be that great, like 8% worse than average, but have awesome comps on them of all guys who are fantastic contact guys, like Mark Burley and Jimmy Key. So that's fun, too. Wade Miley's good to have.
Yeah, they just fundamentally don't believe. Like, their system fundamentally doesn't want to buy that he has a core skill of generating bad contact.
Yeah.
And he clearly does. And I think there's just an acknowledgement that, like, these systems are not going to work real well on guys like Wade Miley. But there's also a certain reality that Wade Miley is walking a tightrope. Like, he has those skills, but when something gets a little bit off and a little bit messed up, Wade Miley can turn into a real soup can. And it happened, you know, earlier in his career quite often. It's been more rare lately, but he's still also walking a tightrope in terms of stuff. Like, at a certain point, his stuff is going to go just below that waterline, and then there's going to be problems. So you kind of know that's coming, right?
Indeed.
Before we were talking, I know Ryan had noted this, that, you know, the starting pitchers, you know, there's not a lot of optimism for the rest of the rotation when it comes to Pecota, but there is a slew of relievers all projected for sub 100 DRA minus totals. So at the very least, Ryan, it looks like the bullpen looks very deep, at least according to the projections.
Yeah, let's get into Mark Putzgarby's question here.
Yeah, sure. So Mark's question, kind of in line with that, asking, how confident are you in guys like Pyamps, Milner, McGill, Peguero, and Bryce Wilson repeating their breakout performances from last season?
On an individual basis, I could see any one of them taking big steps back. I think Pyamps, I feel the best about, because he seemed to take real steps forward in terms of stuff, and there was like real measurable increases there. But guys like Bryce Wilson, it did seem like it might be sort of smoke and mirrors. And until we get a better sense that, because he's kind of doing the Wade Miley thing where he's generating poor contact, and that's like his thing. And I think you really need a much larger sample than what we saw from Bryce Wilson last year to say that that's like a core skill and not just a thing that happened.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, on that perspective, but as a unit, I feel very confident in the group, because they're all just sort of projected to be solidly above average, or, you know, reasonably above average in terms of their run prevention. Like, you just look down, obviously Devin Williams is expected to be great, you know, 35% better than the league average in terms of run prevention. you know, but then you start looking down and Piamps is 10% better than the league average. Milner's 14%. McGill is 7% better. Uribe is 6% better. And I think that sort of undersells like his path upward, but they don't have a very big sample on him yet. So I get it. I understand that that's why that is. Bagheera, 9% better than the league average. JB Bukauskas, of all people, 8% yeah. better than the league average. And if you, I already mentioned it a little bit, but Kurt wrote up guys like Jansen Junk, and they've been bringing in a number of guys this winter who they're going to give a bunch of shots to these guys and see what they can potentially do. And they're so good at this. This is, you know, a core competency that the Brewers have that I think that they're going to have a bullpen as they sort all this out that is a good bullpen. It just may not be those particular guys. There's going to be, and I can guarantee you, there's going to be flux in those names. There's going to be changes. Some of those guys are going to fail and aren't going to be on the team, you know, and maybe even early-ish in the season, within a month or two. But I think that they have the depth, and part of what they do is to just keep this pipeline flowing. So I really do feel confident that that's going to work out. It just may not be those guys.
Ryan, do you know anything about Luke Barker? He sticks out like a sore thumb on this puppy.
Yeah, everybody. Yeah, that's a long-standing thing. Pecota has always loved Luke Barker. I feel like we've had the Luke Barker discussion before. Maybe
so.
Not last year, but like years before. Pecota loves Luke Barker and has forever. It's okay. Just it's one of those things.
He's like the Christian Yelich of pitchers.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Much more modestly, yes, but yeah. But yeah, I mean, you just look at guys like that are on here. Enoli Paredes, who they brought in, who'd pitched some for the Astros. He is projected to be 2% worse than league average in terms of run prevention. You know, a perfectly cromulent middle reliever, in other words. They just have a lot of these guys around that can potentially be, you know, real useful for them. So, I think it's going to Taylor Clark, who they brought in and we discussed, you know, 5% worse than the park adjusted league average. There's just a lot of different ways that they can get to a useful bullpen here.
Part of that might be somebody that we brought up earlier, M. Santana, asking, what's the likelihood of Aaron Ashby making meaningful contributions in 2024? I'm wondering about his injury and if there's a track record of pitchers successfully coming back from that. So, I mean, you look at the projections and he's projected to be one of the better arms, but it's just a matter, Paul, of if he's going to be available.
I have forgotten what Aaron Ashby's injury is. So
shoulder.
Yeah, he has the shoulder injury. He was, people say it's like the Burns, or sorry, like the Woodruff injury, and it's not. It's, shoulders are very complicated and they're very weird, but it's a shoulder injury, and he came back from it late last year, and he didn't have the zip on his stuff, and that's why, you remember in August when they were talking about, oh, Ashby's back and throwing, maybe he could use him down the stretch, and then they're like, nope, that's not going to be happening. He needs, we need more time here.
He needs to build back up. Shoulders are hard, and even shoulders that aren't Woodruff shoulders are hard. They tend to sap weird things, require a lot of buildup. So he's had a lot of time, so he's likely to at least get a shot to contribute this year, but that anytime I see a shoulder, I basically just like, you're off my radar. You're a ghost to me until I see you throw 90 something again. And it's impossible to project. It's not like Tommy John where there's like a road to come back for pretty much everybody. It's you never know. So they're low on pitchers. He'll have a chance if he can throw. Just a matter of if he can actually get healthy off of an injury that's hard to get healthy on.
Yep. Yeah.
Moving on, I guess. Other questions this week. Price Trozen asking, why not Joey Votto? He's been on Twitter talking about no one calling him. I'd love him on the Brewers for a year at first base. He'd be way better than Jesse Winker on personality alone. True. And can't be any worse at the plate. Plus, it would be good content for JR. So the tweet Joey Votto had in just the last couple of days, he said, being a free agent is like that scene from Gravity where Sandra Bullock detaches from the Explorer. You're all alone. No one is answering your calls, and you don't know if you'll get back to base. Your only hope is George Clooney saving you. Save me, George. So obviously he's itching to play, Paul. Outside of Carlos Santana, is he a possibility for another stopgap, or is he just spaghetti at this point?
Yeah, he's definitely spaghetti. I would, not all things equal, Carlos Santana is a better bet to provide production at first base at this point than Votto is. Votto has always been the best at getting on base. He is a first baseman. He's a little bit weird first baseman in that he's got good but not great power, but he has like Yelich-like control of the zone, better than that. Votto is famous for basically never missing a ball and strike call himself, and spitting on things out like an inch outside of the zone. But he's not getting on base, hasn't for 2 years. He might be a useful platoon bat. He is a very fun personality. If they wanted to get him and Granky out of retirement and make them roommates for a year, that would be awesome and film it. I don't think there's much left in Votto anymore. He's just the bats left him at this point, unfortunately.
Yeah, I think that that's accurate, sadly, but it happens to everybody. I mean, he's 40 now, and he kind of had a bounce back last year, and he bounced back to a 0.0 war on Fangraphs, whereas the year before he was negative almost one, negative 0.8. So, yeah, I mean, really the thing is, you're talking about, like, the walks are still there. He still takes his walks, because last year he had a walk rate of 11.2, which is, you know, a few three ticks better than what the league average is, but his batting average has just completely plummeted and bottomed out. He was a 205 in 2022 and a 202 last year, and that's just a really poor baseline. I mean, we've seen that a lot, right? We've, as Brewers fans, we've seen this kind of player over and over and over. Hell, you know, Willy Adames is kind of this guy, though obviously with real power and amazing chops at shortstop, which makes the whole proposition like play a lot better, right? Like that props it up. But
yeah,
Joey Votto is a probably below average first baseman defensively at this point, likely very below average first baseman at this point. And so there's just not much else to recommend other than he's like, you're hoping for a walk and the occasional homer, and other than that, there's not much there.
Yeah, you can maybe use him as a platoon bat, but that's lefty specific, and even that's not a sure thing. He actually wasn't very good against lefties 2 years ago. He was last year, but only against like 40 of them or something, like very small sample size last year in some success against lefties, but that's it. There's not a lot there. It's probably time for Joey to call it a day.
Yeah, that, I mean, we'll see if he gets like a minor league invite to spring training with like the Blue Jays or something like that. Go play for Canada's team and see if you can stick around. But
that does seem like a likely thing that would happen, where they would just bring him in at the last second, you know, sign him like 2 weeks before spring training, say, hey, you want to come to spring training with us and all that.
Yeah. And then he can retire in March. So, all right. Logan Inderdahl has a couple of questions about a pair of pitching moves that happened across the league in the last couple of days here. Frankie Montas joining the Reds and Chris Sale getting traded to the Braves. So first question from Logan is, Frankie Montas just got the same amount of money that Burns will get in ARB. Does the starting pitcher market make a Burns trade more or less likely? And then Chris Sale and money just got Vaughn Grissom. Does that mean Burns could net a top 100 guy? I lean heavily towards yes. Sub question, does this affect your view on Boston as a trade partner? So Ryan, let's start with you. First of all, Frankie Montas going to the Reds for what was it, like $16 million on a 1 year deal?
Yep.
And then Chris Sale getting Vaughn Grissom. Although the a lot of money changing hands just to get that prospect too, but your takes on both of them.
Yeah, I hesitate to read too much into things like this in terms of what Burns is worth and in terms of what people are going to do, because I do get the distinct impression, and I may be over relying on what Scott Boras said at the winter meetings here, but he was pretty definite about the idea that he didn't think the Brewers were looking to move Burns this winter. And so I think that the Brewers' position should be, and I hope is, that if somebody wants to come in and blow you away with an offer where they give you a ton of future value, present and future value, I should say, like they're not going to be trading Corbin Burns for a package that doesn't help them this year. They're going to at least need something this year from that. But it's going to have just a tremendous amount of value to them for them to be able to make this move at this point. I really hope that's kind of where they're standing on it. And I think the indications that we have are that that is kind of where they're at with it. So maybe they are just waiting for teams to get desperate once, you know, the shuffling stops. You know, maybe the Yankees are really desperate. Maybe the Red Sox are desperate. One of those teams is really willing to like pay the piper for 1 year of Corbin Burns. But Burns unhelpfully went out, I think it was in the last few weeks, and basically said, no, guys, I'm not signing an extension. I'm going to free agency. So yep. Kind of putting to bed that idea. And so I think that anybody that's doing this is doing it with the understanding they're getting 1 year of Corbin Burns and not much advantage beyond that.
Right. And given that, I think that actually makes him less likely to be traded. I think that's all correct. And the reason it's less likely to be traded isn't just that it limits their return right now. It's that there's when that is the case, when you're not going to be able to sign him to a long-term deal because of, you know, familiarity, getting him on your team, whatever. The difference between trading him now and at the deadline becomes far, far, far less than it otherwise would be. Now you've got time to do deals and stuff. The deadline offers you obviously less time with that player, but a much higher leverage impact with that player. You know where you are, and a win or two can put you in the playoffs. There's no reason to trade him before the season starts. If they have a bad season and it gets to be the trade deadline, they'll probably get almost as much back for him as if they traded right now. So you may as well keep him for, you know, the first part of the season, see how it goes. And then you can be the team that keeps him if you are actually in the playoff hunt and make that happen for yourself. So that's what's going to happen there. They're not going to trade him before the season. I would be shocked if they did. The Sale thing's crazy, by the way. I can't believe it. Chris Sale, I have thought, has been done for a while now and also likely to have his arm fall off for a while now. And is pretty old. I can't believe he got back a decent prospect. I know a lot of that was a bought prospect. James was right about that. But like that was too much for Chris Sale. And even with money, that was a lot.
Do we know what the money was that went with Sale?
It was like 20 some million.
It was 20.
It was a big number. Significant.
I don't remember what it was specifically, but when I saw it, I was like, well, that is a lot of money there. That's like a good chunk of payroll there.
Yeah. And like, I think you're probably right about that. Oh, hey, he's from Lakeland, Florida. My folks live there. I have a place there. It's really, really tough to try to like parse out what is going on. Cause part of his question here was, does this affect your view of Boston as a trade partner? Not really. I still think they're probably going to be cautious. And I thought that before this, but it is interesting that they basically did use money to go out and buy Vaughn Grissom, who had an outstanding year at AAA this year. And was, I guess he was passable at the big league level. Like the numbers are there. It's kind of empty batting average is what it is. Like he had a reasonable batting average in like the 280s, but not much of an on-base percentage and not much slugging. But there was some weird stuff going on. Remember Vaughn Grissom was supposed to be the replacement for Dansby Swanson?
Yep.
Like that's why they were like, yep, we're going to let Dansby Swanson go. We've got Vaughn Grissom. And then something was so objectionable about him in spring training of last year that they surprise sent him down and made Orlando Arcia the starting shortstop. And from that point on, it was like they were kind of done with Vaughn Grissom. I don't know if there was like bad blood there or whatever, but Grissom produced a lot in AAA. He was good. So this one is just weird. I don't know. Part of me thinks that the Red Sox, like the play here for the Braves is they want to, you know, suck the last marrow out of the bones of Chris Sale and get the last potential usefulness that he has left.
Sure.
But yeah, it's kind of a fascinating trade. I'm trying to see what the money part of it was, but
it was actually so the 20 that I had in my head is 27.5 salary for the year, but Braves are getting $17 million to cover that. So Boston picking up 17 of the 27.5. So basically they've got Chris Sale for $10.5 million.
And this is the final year of his contract then, or does he still have years left?
I believe so. No, I believe this is the last year of that contract he had signed with Boston. So, you know, if you think of it as like, if you can get, what, 80 really good innings out of Chris Sale at $10.5 million, maybe. That's the thing. It's like, you can't really pencil him in for 30 starts.
No, it's interesting, though. Last year, amidst the injuries, he managed to pitch 102 innings. He did put up a 4.30 ERA, but, you know, some of that is just Boston and the AL East, like, is going to push that up. A 1.13 whip and 125 strikeouts. Like, he was actually a decent-ish – he was a Baseball Reference worth 1.7 wins. He was actually a decent-ish pitcher for them last year, but, yeah, it's he's always hurt. Like, he just – there's something always going wrong with him. Which was Keith Law's original concern, why he really like missed on Sale and was like, yeah, I can't see this guy ever being a good starter. And he was for a long time. But then eventually that delivery and the frame just kind of broke down. It looks like he has a vesting option for 2025, $20 million. But he has to finish top 10 in the Cy Young voting.
Yeah, no.
Seems unlikely.
Not happening. I mean, even if he's not a starter, you could see him maybe as like a – you know, Andrew Miller, old school Josh Hader, like
okay, sure.
Two innings, just mow down the middle of the order in the sixth and seventh inning and call it a day. I
right.
mean, that could be valuable for the Braves, too.
And then take 4 days off. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. All right. Throb Zombie, next question, asking thoughts on projecting the week, month ahead next season. Something like, this is what I think a good week or month is. This is a bad one. And this is what I think they will do. Ryan, what do you think?
Yeah, so we were trying to parse this question and figure out what exactly he was driving at, because it's tough. Baseball is kind of a sport where I expect next year, no matter what they're, you know, whether they end up winning 65 games or 95 games next year, and I think 65 is ridiculously low. That doesn't seem likely at all. But I would sort of expect them to have weeks where they were like 6-0, 6-1, 7-0. And I would also expect weeks where they were like 0-6. They had, you know, what they had a 6-game losing streak this year to the A's and the Twins. And,
yeah.
You know, like, you would sort of expect good and bad weeks, even if the team is like winning 100 or losing 100. So to try to parse it on like a week by week basis, I don't know. I think they're going to be a better than 500 team next year. I think they're, you know, in that 85 to 90 win range. That's what I'm expecting them to be. And what is that on a week by week basis? It varies wildly.
We kind of do that a little bit. Like, we'll look ahead at the schedule and see if they have, like, you know, the Murderers Row road trip coming up or a bunch of easy teams. And we'll point that out most of the time. But like, It tends not to be like they had a losing record against Detroit and Colorado last year and Oakland and a bunch of other garbage. And they seem to be fairly unpredictable in terms of how any given week's going to go. There's too many factors. Like, you know, you don't know who's going to be starting 5, 6, 7 days out for the other team or for the Brewers, or who's going to be injured, or, you know, a zillion other things. So, yeah, we'll mention when it looks tough, but it tends not to look as tough when they actually get there most of the time.
Yeah, it tends to just sort of play against expectations because it's baseball, and, you know, even really bad teams will beat really good teams on a fairly consistent basis. So it's baseball.
Ian Pomplin, our next question this week, asking, what's your favorite ways to watch the Brewers, and how many games do you typically watch a year? I vaguely remember it being mentioned that one person watches the games on mute. Paul, that's absolutely
one person,
you.
One person, yes.
Yeah, well, because you don't watch the sound on anything, really, right?
That's correct, yes. Especially sports. I do on television shows. That would be something. Something.
I'm at sports, yes. Yeah.
But I don't like announcers. They bother me. They often say the wrong thing, so I turn them off. But yeah, that's me. I watch on, I live out of state, so I get the MLB ticket package, whatever they call it. And I watch almost every game. I usually do watch every game eventually, even if I catch the condensed version later on. But if there's a game on, unless I'm at work doing something, you know, that it actually involves hardcore work, which does happen fairly regularly. I don't have the game on then. But I'll watch pretty much every game that way.
Yeah, I would say I see a huge chunk of these games. And if I'm driving, if we're going someplace on a trip, I'll put it on the radio. So I hear a decent number of games, too. I will put games on mute, especially when my wife is around, because she would prefer to have music on, and it's fine.
Right.
So I'll just put music on then, and the game will be on mute. And so I would say I definitely listen to games more than Paul does. But a decent amount of time I'm on mute with music on instead. So, yeah, but most games I was at, I had a running tally. I've been keeping that the last couple of years. I think I was at about 30 games this year. So I was at a good chunk of the homestand. We have a partial season seat package. And so I was at a solid chunk of the games this last year. So that's actually, you know, another way. Like I preferably... I really enjoy watching it in person, and also especially with the shortened games, that made it so much easier to be able to go to games on school nights. Like that is just, sure. That's so wonderful to be able to, like, especially now that they're doing those 6:40 starts. So when they start at 6:40 and you've got, you know, the pitch clock going, you honestly, on a lot of nights, I'm back home, like back at my house, like ready to like get ready for bed at like 9:15, 9:30. It's great. It's absolutely wonderful.
That's nice. Absolutely. JD, our next question. Do you view Gary Sheffield as a Hall of Famer? To me, he's a slam dunk. Seems like he'll fall short on his final year on the writer's ballot. So this is Hall of Fame ballot reveal season as the deadline comes near. But Paul, looks like Sheffield's going to be left out for a variety of reasons.
I think lesson one with Sheffield, first of all, I'm actually pretty surprised he's not gonna make it. He had a lot of defenders for the Hall of Fame like 25 years ago when he was still on the Yankees. Like Joe Morgan famously was very much into that, and I know Joe Morgan became a thing, which was kind of unfair in retrospect, but like, I feel like a lot of media liked Gary Sheffield and thought he was super great. And that seems to have fallen off a bit. I do think he is a little bit of a tough personality, and he's very borderline. And so in terms of just raw statistics, he's real close. I'm actually like, he's a 60 war B war guy. I think he's right around there with everybody else, which like on just 60 is kind of my, I think it's kind of everybody's like, that's the borderline for most mm-hmm. positions, except for relief pitchers. And so I kind of get it. And he had a good peak, but not like a super, super good peak. Just a tricky one. I don't know what I would do for Sheffield. I feel like I'm too biased to give an opinion of Sheffield. And his early Brewer tenure was rough on both sides. Like, he was definitely a jerk about it. But I know that he had legitimate complaints about the organization and the medical staff at the time. And so what are you going to do? However, he also did himself a big disservice when he was with the Brewers, because had he knocked out five more WAR with us, he probably would have made the Hall of Fame. So I would probably vote no, because he's borderline and I'm at least a little bit petty. But I'm genuinely shocked he's fallen off and that he didn't get in. I thought he was a slam dunk when he retired.
Well, he does have the PED thing. So
yes. I forgot he had the PED thing.
He's in the Mitchell report.
He's in the Mitchell report.
He was the Belko scandal. He and Barry Bonds were the big Belko.
Yeah, he was never one of the McGuire Sosa like types, like hitting monstrous forever. But yeah, I forgot he was a steroid guy. I guess I'm never surprised when a steroid guy falls off at this point.
Yeah, I think that's the big thing here, is he's a borderline case. I think that's true. 62.1, by the way, Fangraphs WAR. So yeah. Right in that same neighborhood.
They're all right about 60, I think. I'm trying to pull a prospectus right now, but I'm not going to get it in time.
Yeah, so very much a borderline case. And in that case, guys who have some like the fact he's in the Mitchell report, I don't think anybody who's in the Mitchell report has gotten in to the Hall of Fame yet, have they? Like,
nope.
The thing that's weird about all that is we do think David Ortiz failed the steroid test in that initial one where it was mm-hmm. not a binding one. It wasn't individual, and nobody was ever supposed to know that, like, he individually failed that test in 2004. But that was the one that if a certain percentage of MLB players failed it, then they were going to start doing testing. And that was mm-hmm. that was the test he supposedly did. And he got into the Hall of Fame based on that. And there were whispers about, obviously, a bunch of guys who've gotten in. Mike Piazza had whispers. Jeff Bagwell had whispers. You know, like all the, remember the back knee stuff about Mike Piazza? I mean,
yeah.
So guys who are suspected have gotten in, and some of them were delayed a little bit. I think Piazza got delayed a little bit, as did Bagwell got sort of held back a little bit because of that. But there are definitely guys who used PEDs, a lot of them, really, in the Hall of Fame. But, yeah, because he has the Mitchell Report thing, I think it's a non-starter.
Yeah.
All right, last question on episode 314 here. PJ Wessel's saying, happy pie episode. In honor of this, do you have a favorite pie, and does it change based on the time of year? I'm definitely team pie over team cake. I will say that. And apple pie is my go-to any time of year. It's pretty much the perfect pie. But Paul, how about you?
Apple a lot of the time, but I actually really like a good rhubarb pie or strawberry rhubarb pie. Those are awesome too. So also with you on pie over cake, pie is much better than cake. Cake is just empty calories.
Cake, if you get the right sort of cake, sponge cakes are good. Like the Tres Leches cakes, those sorts of cakes. Can be pretty good. It sort of depends on what you're doing, but yeah, I also pie over those. Cinnamon apple pie is, I think, is it like everybody's favorite? It's the flavor that they use at McDonald's, for God's sake. Like, it's you know, like that's everybody's one. But yeah, I would say like a key lime pie, good key lime pie,
very
refreshing.
One.
Those are nice in the right context. A lemon meringue pie, those sorts of things, good. Very much enjoy those as well. My great aunt was very, very good at making those, and that was always a highlight of going to her place. So yeah, very much those. But yes, pie is good.
I feel like this just popped into my head, so let's just have one last food debate for nostalgia's sake. Is cheesecake a cake or is it a pie?
It's delicious is what it is, James.
Yeah, I guess I think it raises larger questions about about
everything's a salad. Yeah,
well, a fruit pie versus more like the lemon meringue pie, where or the French silk pie, which I feel like is also barely a pie. If it's just filled with goo, I'm not sure it should count. It might maybe should get its own category, like a tart or something like that. So I'd lean it more in that, like, cheesecake's more of a tart than either one of those two things.
Okay. Yeah. We'll leave it there for now. If you're listening, have any strong opinions on whether cheesecake is a pie or a cake, I guess just let us know either in the comments on Patreon or on social media. We'll leave it there. That does it for questions this week. But thank you for all the patrons for those questions. A reminder, new patrons too also get a shout out when they join up. Looks like we've got a couple of names to say thanks to. Ryan, who do we have?
Yeah, Matthew Keating and David Quinlan. Welcome. We thank you very much for joining up. Hope you're enjoying the minor league extras and Paul's predictions and all those sorts of things. We greatly appreciate it.
Absolutely.
That we do. Welcome aboard.
Welcome. So a reminder, you can go become a patron at patreon.com/MKETailgate. $2 a month, you get your question answered either here or on reporting as eligible every week. $5, as Ryan mentioned, you get that extra content as well. Definitely a good time of year to go check in on all that stuff, especially as we, you know, wrap up the regular season for the Packers. Hopefully a playoff spot coming up. We'll see what happens later tonight.
Nah, feeling rough on this one, so hopefully they wise up for it. But
ugh. Yeah, I just have like recurring trauma from watching the Packers on what must win games in prime time. That Detroit game last year really ruined me. So not optimistic, but I'll be listening with eager ears to Paul and the rest of the gang on reporting as eligible. That'll do it for us this week. Be on the lookout for all that stuff. Hope you all have a very, very happy new year. Stay happy, healthy, all that good stuff. We thank you for listening to us, and we'll be back here next time on Milwaukee's Tailgate.